ईश्वरः सर्वभूतानां ईश्वरः सर्वभूतानां हृद्देशे अर्जुन तिष्ठति सर्वत्र यो मां पश्यति सर्वत्र सर्वं च मयि पश्यति तस्याहं न प्रणश्यामि स च मे न प्रणश्यति बस्ती में या की बन में तू ढूढ़ता है जिसको तू ढूढ़ता है जिसको बस्ती में या की बन में तू ढूढ़ता वह सावरा सलोना रखता है तेरे दिल में तू ढूढ़ता है जिसको तू ढूढ़ता हर जरे में रमा है हर फूल में बसा है हर जरे हर चीज में उसी का जलवा झलक रहा है हर चीज में उसी का जलवा झलक रहा है वह सांवरा सलोना वह सांवरा सलोना वह तेरे दिल में तो ढूढ़ता 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 जिसको
unique among the scriptures of the world in as much as it is amazingly universal in character completely free from even the faintest touch of sectarianism In fact, it is fully infused with a scientific temper. The Gita is in the form of a dialogue between the teacher and the pupil. Throughout the stimulating discussion between the two, the teacher encourages the pupil to ask question after question, thus keeping the flame of inquiry ever active and ablaze. The central theme of the Gita is evident in the very first verse of the first discourse. The Gita is not concerned with the alleged mythological or historical war between the two clans of the same family, the Pandavas and the Kauravas. The concern of the Gita is with the psychological war that goes on continually in the hearts and the minds of human beings all over the world. It is always difficult to see clearly what happens in this inner battlefield of life. The Gita deals with this difficulty facing all human beings. The Gita begins with the question raised by the blind king Dhritarashtra, who wants to know as to what is happening in this battle of life. And so he asks Sanjaya, who is endowed with an objective and an impersonal perception, to describe to him the actual happenings on the field of war. Most of us are figuratively blind, and so are unable to see clearly the happenings of life without introducing an element of likes and dislikes in the very act of observation. To be able to see life without attachment and repulsion, to have a clear perception of life's happenings, is the principal theme of the Gita. However, to see life impersonally does not mean to be indifferent towards the happenings of life. Right perception does not require a stepping out of the battle of life. The Gita nowhere talks of the renunciation of life. The dialogue between the teacher Sri Krishna and the pupil Arjuna centers around this principal teaching. In order to impart picturesqueness to the subject matter, the author of the Gita has given a setting of the physical war so as to describe the inner and the psychological conflict of man with greater effectiveness. Arjuna is seated in his chariot and Sri Krishna is acting as the charioteer. This is once again a part of the symbolism of the Gita. Arjuna represents the human intellect, even as Sri Krishna symbolizes intelligence or the buddhi. In man's life, there are two seemingly opposite areas of action. One is dharma and the other is karma. These are constituted by the ideal and the actual in life. Between these two, there is going on a continual battle, and the Gita is concerned with the problems of this inner war. Arjuna desires to run away from the battle of life. As he moves in this chariot towards the battlefield, he hears the blowing of the conches from different sides. The blowing of the conches is done by the commanders of the various units of the army on both the sides. Distracted by the battle cry of the warriors and the blowing of the conches, Arjuna requests Sri Krishna to place his chariot between the two armies so that he could see who are on his side and who are in the opposite camp. This symbolism of the Gita suggests that the chariot of our lives is also placed between the two armies. The army is represented by dharma and karma, the ideals and the actuals of life. Witnessing the two armies causes immense disturbance to Arjuna. Why should this have happened? Did Arjuna not know who were on his side and who were in the opposite camp? Obviously he knew, and yet why was he disturbed when the chariot was placed between the two armies? Why did Arjuna, who was a dauntless warrior, develop a sense of dejection on witnessing the two armies and their compositions? He said to the Lord and the Master, Sri Krishna, "I will not fight." Why did this happen to Arjuna? What caused this faint-heartedness in such a fearless warrior as Arjuna? Arjuna was in a state of despondency. But why?
धर्मक्षेत्रे कुरुक्षेत्रे समवेतायुयुत्सवः मामकाः पाण्डवाश्चैव किं कुर्वत सञ्जय दृष्ट्वा तु पाण्डवानीकम् व्यूढं दुर्योधनस्तदा आचार्यमुपसङ्गम्य राजवचनमब्रवीत् पश्यैतं पाण्डुपुत्राणाम् आचार्य महतीं च व्यूढां द्रुपदपुत्रेण तव शिष्येण धीमता अत्र शूराः महेश्वासाः भीमार्जुन समायुधि युयोधानो विराटश्च द्रुपदश्च महारथः అన్నే చ బహవః శూరాః మదర్థే త్యక్త జీవితాః నానా శస్త్ర ప్రహరణాః సర్వే యుద్ధ విశారదాః తస్య సంజనయన్ హర్షం కురువృద్ధః పితామహః సింహనాదం వినద్య ఉచ్చైః శంఖం దద్మౌ ప్రతాపవాన్ ద్రుపదో ద్రౌపదేయాశ్చ సర్వశః పృథివీపతి సౌభద్రశ్చ మహాబాహు శంఖాన్ దద్ముః పృథక్ పృథక్ ఋషికేశం తదా వాక్యం ఇదం ఆహ మహీపతే సేనయోరుభయోర్మధ్యే రథం స్థాపయమిచ్యుతే ఏవముక్తో ఋషికేశో గుడాకేశేన భారత సేనయోరుభయోర్మధ్యే స్థాపయిత్వా రథోత్తమం
To recognize something intellectually and to actually see it are two completely different experiences. One does intellectually recognize the inevitability of death, and yet when one hears its footsteps, one is greatly disturbed and even deeply frightened. This was exactly what happened to Arjuna. He knew that in the opposite camp, where such highly venerated sires as Bhishma and Drona, when one is engaged in war, one is merciless towards those who may be in the opposite camp. A war is no respecter of persons. War demands a total annihilation of the opposite camp. Arjuna was obviously aware of this factor, inherent in all wars, as he had fought many a fierce battle. As he witnessed the two armies from his chariot, he visualized the killings not only of Bhishma and Drona, but also of his numerous relatives on both the sides. Naturally, these relatives would also be killed in the event of war. Surely he knew all this before his chariot was placed between the two armies. But when he actually saw the grim prospects of war, not a mere intellectual possibility, then did he experience something for which he was not prepared. In actual witnessing of the compositions of the two armies, the centers of personal attachment in Arjuna's consciousness were stimulated and awakened. It was this which was the cause of his desire to step out of the war. The recoil from war was obviously due to the awakening of the centers of psychological attachment. Earlier, when the negotiations for peace had failed, Arjuna himself had gone to Sri Krishna, seeking his help in the war that was imminent. The traditional story of the Mahabharata says that Sri Krishna made it clear to him that he would not fight, even though he would be willing to help his friend and disciple. Arjuna then told his teacher that he did not want Sri Krishna to fight at all, and added that he was not afraid of fighting, since he had fought many a battle valiantly and without fear. Arjuna wanted Sri Krishna to direct his chariot and nothing more. Thus did Sri Krishna become Arjuna's charioteer in the great battle of Mahabharata. But after having said this, and after giving an assurance to Sri Krishna that he was not afraid of the battle and that he would fight, why did he go back on this word and tell Shri Krishna that he would not fight. Obviously, the reason for this reversal of decision lay in the fact that having witnessed the two armies, his feelings of attachment became greatly stirred. The mind has an immense storehouse of excuses, and the cleverer the mind, the cleverer are the excuses offered for doing or for not doing a particular piece of work. Arjuna surely had a very clever mind. He said to Shri Krishna, "What use is victory in the war if it has to be at the expense of losing venerable sires and loving friends and relations? To live without them after victory in the war would be meaningless." But this was not all. Arjuna said to the Lord, "Of what use is this fratricidal war, the result of which will be utter confusion in society and in social relationships?" He said, "The war will result in utter chaos." Knowing this, why was he urging him to fight? These were clever excuses, perhaps used as a cover to hide something which he did not wish to reveal. Arjuna very well knew that wars always result in killings, and very often in the killings of the near and dear ones. Then why this sudden outburst of righteous indignation against war and the killings that ensue? So determined Arjuna was that he threw away his bow and arrows as a revolt against war and the killings that would ensue. His great bow Gandiva, with which he had gone to war many a time, was thrown away, indicating his firm resolve not to fight. He asked his lord and master what moral principles were going to be upheld by killing such great teachers as Bhishma and Drona. What pattern of social relationship would emerge after the merciless killings of dear and near ones? Arjuna refused to be involved in the war, and this refusal to be involved arose out of his sense of attachments. Shri Krishna had to indicate to Arjuna that he could not run away from the battlefield. Surely one cannot run away from the battle of life, even though the situations may be adverse. The true principle of living is involvement without attachment. But is this not a paradoxical? It is commonly believed that if there is no attachment, there can be no involvement either. It is commonly understood that involvement and attachment go together.
Gandivam Sramsati Hastai
त्वक्षैव परिदयते न च शक्नोमि अवस्थातुं भ्रमति वच मे मन न कांक्षे विजयं कृष्ण न च राज्यं सुखानि च किन्नो राज्येन गोविन्द किं भोगैर् जीवितेन वा अपि त्रैलोक्यराज्यस्य हेतुः किं महि कृते कुलक्षये प्रणश्यन्ति कुलधर्माः सनातनः धर्मे नष्टे कुलं कृत्स्नं अधर्मो भी भावत्युते अधर्मो विसृज्य स शरणं शोक संविघ्न मानसः शोक संविघ्न मानसः
Discourse of the Bhagavad Gita, one finds Arjuna in a strange predicament. He has thrown away his bow and the arrows, telling Shri Krishna that he would not fight. This appeared to be his firm and irrevocable decision. And yet in the midst of this decision, he seemed to be indecisive. He was not certain whether he had made the right decision. He was still in a state of despondency. If he had decided once and for all, then why this despondency? Shri Krishna asked Arjuna as to why he was in such a state of dejection. The teacher told the pupil that it did not behove him to be overtaken by such despondency. Shri Krishna demolishes all the arguments of Arjuna for not fighting by just one remark. He says to Arjuna, "You speak like a learned man, but your action belies your words of wisdom." He tells Arjuna that the wise do not grieve either for the dead or for the living. This seems to be a strange statement, for who would grieve for the living? However, the above statement is full of deep meaning, for in the second discourse of the Gita, the teacher reveals the mystery both of life as well as death for the benefit of the pupil. Before dealing with the problem of life and death, the teacher seems to be gauging the depth of the pupil's despondency. And so the problem is first discussed at the surface level. The teacher admonishes Arjuna by saying that he who belongs to the warrior class as Arjuna did cannot refrain from fighting. What would people say about him who refrained from being involved in a battle? Surely such a one would meet with utter disgrace in his community. The Lord tells the pupil that if he meets with defeat in the battle, he would go to heaven because of his engagement in a righteous war. And if he meets with victory, then he would be the unchallenged ruler of the world. But these words of the master did not cut much ice with the pupil, for the problem of Arjuna was much deeper. He was not afraid to fight, and so the prospects of defeat or victory did not weigh with him at all. Surely Arjuna was not afraid of his own death, but he could not reconcile himself to the grim prospect of being an instrument for the killing of Bhishma and Drona and his numerous relatives. It was the death of those whom he revered and those whom he loved which made him a victim of intense grief. He was deeply concerned with the problem of death, the death which would cause separation between himself and those whom he revered and those whom he loved. And so in the second discourse of the Gita, we find an illuminating discussion about the problem of death, a discussion such as is not to be found in any religious literature of the world. The teacher says to Arjuna that that which is born must die, and that which dies must be reborn. This is the law of nature, and as such it is inevitable or unavoidable. The Lord says to the pupil that to weep for the inevitable is utterly meaningless. Of what use is this lamentation for something that is inevitable? But even this does not mollify Arjuna. Then the Sri Krishna discussed the entire problem of death. He makes an astonishing statement by saying that both the killer and the killed are illusions, for there is neither the killer nor the killed. One may ask, what is the justification for this statement? The Lord says that the destruction of the body is not the destruction of the individual. Man is not the body. Then what is he? The Gita here propounds the profound philosophy of the soul. Arjuna is asked to discover the soul. In Kathopanishad, the young inquirer Nachiketa, who wanted to know the secret of death, was told by Yama, the lord of death, to discover the soul, for he said the soul was the one thing he could not touch. Then Nachiketa asked Yama, "Sir, what is soul?" The answer that Yama gave tallies exactly with the description of the soul given in the Bhagavad Gita. Here the soul is described as the unborn. The soul never dies because it is never born. It is ever the unborn. Soul is not the invisible but the unborn. How can the unborn ever be killed? Man is not the body but the soul. Even though the soul is unborn, it is intangibly present in all that is born. It is the unborn that imparts a livingness to all that is born. When the touch of the unborn and the unmanifest is lost, then all that is born and manifested loses its livingness. He who can be aware of the unborn in the manifest, the intangible in the tangible, has known the secret of death. It is the intangible that is the soul of all things. The tangible is ever changing. It is the intangible that forever is changeless. And the changeless can be discovered in the ever-changing forms and patterns of life. He who can see the changeless in the ever-changing has gone beyond death. But how to see the unborn in all that is born? What are the characteristics of one who has come to this experience?
Like
पद्यते क्षुद्रं हृदयदर्वयं त्यक्त्वो तिष्ठ परन्तप कथं भीष्ममहं संख्ये द्रोणं च मधुसूदन इषूभिः प्रतियोत्स्यामि पूजार्हावरिसूदन कार्पण्यदोषो पहत स्वभावः पृच्छामि त्वा धर्मसंढचेताः यच्छ्रेह्य स्यान् निश्चितं ब्रूहि तन्मे शिष्यस्तेऽहं शादिमां त्वां प्रपन्नं शिष्यस्ते अशोच्यानन् वशोचस्त्वं प्रज्ञावादांश्च भाषसे गतासून् गतासूंश्च नानुशोचन्ति पण्डिताः न त्वेवाहं जातु नासौ न त्वं नेमे जनाधिपाः न चैव न भविष्यामः सर्वे वयमतः परं देहिनोऽस्मिन् यथा देहि कौमारं यौवनं जरा तथा देहान्तरप्राप्तिः धीरस्तत्र न मुह्यति मात्रा स्पर्शात् दुःखदाः आगमापायिनो नित्यास्तां स्थितिक्षस्व भारत नासतो विद्यते भा त्वनयोस्तत्त्वदर्शिभिः येन वेत्ति हन्तारं यश्चैनं मन्यते जायते म्रियते वा कदाचिन् न जायते म्रियते वा कदाचिन् नायं भूत्वा भविता वा न शाश्वतोऽयं पुराणो शाश्वतोऽयं पुराणो न हन्यते हन्यमाने शरीरे।
In deep despondency, Shri Krishna asks, "What are you weeping about?" He tells him that the unreal has no existence and the real never dies. If this be so, why is man afraid of death? What is it that dies if the soul is unborn and deathless? Is not the death of the unreal a contradiction in terms? If the unreal has no existence, how can one speak of its death? The unreal has a fictitious existence. When man identifies himself with his false existence, then does he regard it as the real. Strangely enough, it is the death of the non-existent. The killer and the killed both are illusions. It is only when this ignorance of the killer and the killed is dispelled that it would be possible for Arjuna to come out of his despondency. It is only when the image dies that the true act of living can emerge. Indeed, it is in the death of the image that the fulfillment of the life begins. Man moves from image to image with an interval which truly is death, and it is in this interval that the vision of the real is vouchsafed to him. As the Gita says, death is like the discarding of the old and the tattered clothes, and so there is no doubt that life fulfills itself in death. All perceptions of the mind are colored by its conditioning. This conditioning is caused by mind's habits, its conflicts and its conclusions. Any perception that arises out of these conditionings can never be right. Indicating the path of right perception, Shri Krishna asks Arjuna to rise above all conditioning factors. The meaning of life can be found only when one looks at happenings of life, free from all conditioning, whether of habits or of conflicts or of conclusions. To have right perception is to observe life without the limitations of the mind. The man of such perception is described by the Gita by the word yukta, meaning totally integrated. Now, total integration demands a steadiness of the mind, what the Gita calls the sthita prajna. But Arjuna wants to know as to what are the characteristics of the man of the steady mind. How does he behave? How does he speak? How does he sit, etc.? To this inquiry of Arjuna, Shri Krishna does not give a direct answer. Most people regard spiritual life a matter of imitation, but one can never come to spiritual experience by an imitation of the behavior pattern of one who is regarded as a spiritual person. Spirituality is not just a pattern of behavior, it is a state of being. Arjuna thought that if he could know the characteristics or the behavior patterns of a spiritual man, then he could easily displace such behavior patterns by an act of imitation and thus become an integrated individual. But Shri Krishna gave to Arjuna no such base for imitation. However, he described to Arjuna the fundamental basis of spiritual life so that he may awaken within himself the spiritual being which lay dormant in his life. One may ask, what was the description of the spiritual or integrated man which Shri Krishna gave for the edification of his pupil? This forms part of the second half of the second discourse of the Gita.
वासांसि जीर्णानि यथा विह नवानि गृह्णाति नरोपराणि तथा शरीराणि विहाय जीर्णानि यन्यानि संयान्ति नवानि देहि दहति पावकः न चैनं क्लेदयन्त्यापो न शोषयति मारुतः अव्यक्तो यमचिन्त्योऽयम् अविकार्योऽयमुच्यते तस्मादेवं विदित्वैन शोचितुमर्हसि ज्ञातस्य हि ध्रुवो मृत्युः ध्रुवं जन्म मृतस्य च तस्माद् परिहार्येऽर्थे न त्वं शोचितुमर्हसि न त्वं शोचितुमर्हसि न त्वं शोचितुमर्हसि
Person who knows how to live is never afraid of death. If there is a fear of death, then it casts its shadow all the time on one's processes of living. When this happens, how can one live at all? He who lives completely has no fear of death. He whose life has been lived incompletely needs the time continuity in order to complete that which has remained incomplete. To live completely, from moment to moment, is indeed the secret of living. Shri Krishna tells Arjuna that true living is possible only when it emerges from the state of the steady mind. This alone is the right starting point for true living. To live is to act, And so the point of right living is itself the point of our right action. But then what does this state of steady mind mean? Is the state of the steady mind a condition of passivity, a state of being uninvolved in the happenings of life? In fact, the state of the steady mind is an intensely dynamic state, totally involved in the play of life and yet utterly free from all attachments. It is a fact that the highest spiritual truths have always been expressed in the language of a paradox. Talking about the state of the steady mind, Sri Krishna says that it neither accepts nor rejects. It neither justifies nor condemns. This is something the mind of man cannot understand, for mind functions in the realm of either or. The Bhagavad Gita describes the man of the steady mind as a self-contained individual. This is not to be confused with a self-satisfied individual. The self-contained man is one who is psychologically not dependent upon any external factor. He seeks his happiness, not in any external circumstance, human or otherwise. The second discourse of the Gita is deeply and profoundly psychological. The second part of this discourse is concerned with the act of living. With the arrival of man on the evolutionary scene, there has taken place a shift from biology to psychology. In the Sanskrit language, there are two words which are of great significance in understanding the psychological processes with which man is concerned in his act of living. These words are vastu, meaning the fact of life, and vishaya, meaning mind's superimpositions on the facts of life. The vishaya is the object of the mind, even as vastu is the object of the senses. The Gita says it is comparatively easy to turn away from the objects of the senses, but the objects of the mind persist in the form of a relish. Round about the relish of a thing, the mind erects its own structure of psychological pain and pleasure. The Gita says that out of this psychological relish arises a confusion of memory, and with this confusion of memory, one's intelligence gets clouded. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that he was suffering from the confusion of memory, so that instead of looking at the facts of life, he was distracted by what the mind had superimposed on the actualities of life. In one of the most beautiful verses of the Gita, in the second discourse, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that the ocean receives all the streams that come to it, whether muddy or crystal clear, without bringing in the element of choice. Similarly, if man could receive in his consciousness all the impulses of life without any selective process, then he will know real peace and quiet of the mind. Here Gita uses the word karma, which is usually translated as desire. In the verse just referred to, the Gita says, "He in whom all desires flow without any selective process will know the peace and silence of the mind." This means that such a man neither justifies nor condemns whatever life brings, and because of this, he comes to the experience of the quiet of the mind. And yet again, in the very next verse, the Gita says that he who rejects all desires, he alone knows the peace and quiet of the mind. This seems utterly confusing and deeply paradoxical. This is so because the word karma has two meanings, one desire and the other craving. When desire is given a continuity by thought, then craving comes into existence. The Gita says that by the rejection of craving and by allowing the stream of desire to flow into one's consciousness without resort to a process of selection, man can come to the peace of mind. But the question arises, where is then the place for action? Does not allowing the flow of desire to enter one's consciousness without let or hindrance suggest a gospel of passivity? But for this, we must turn to the philosophy of action propounded by the Gita.
Sthita prajnasya ka bhasha
समाधिस्थस्य केशव स्थितधि किं प्रभाषेत किमासीत व्रजेत किं प्रजहाति यदा कामान् सर्वान् पार्थ मनोगतान् आत्मन्येवात्मनातुष्ट स्थितप्रज्ञस्तदुच्यते दुःखेष्वनुद्विग्नमनाः सुखेषु विगतस्पृहः वीतरागभयक्रोधः स्थितधिर्मुनिरुच्यते यः सर्वत्रानभिस्नेहः तत्तत्प्राप्य शुभाशुभम् नाभिनन्दति न द्वेष्टि तस्य प्रज्ञा प्रतिष्ठिता यदा संहरति चायं कूर्मोऽङ्गानीव सर्वशः इन्द्रियाणीन्द्रियार्थेभ्यः तस्य प्रज्ञा प्रतिष्ठिता विषया विनिवर्तन्ते निराहारस्य देहिनः रसवर्जं रसोऽप्यस्य परं दृष्ट्वा निवर्तते यततो ह्यपि कौन्ते पुरुषस्य विपश्चितः इन्द्रियाणि प्रमाथीनि हरन्ति प्रसभं मनः तानि सर्वाणि संयम्य युक्तासीत् मत्परः वशे हि यस्येन्द्रियाणि तस्य प्रज्ञा प्रतिष्ठिता ध्यायतो विषयान् पुंसः सङ्गस्तेषूपजायते सङ्गात् सञ्जायते कामः कामाक्रोधोऽभिजायते क्रोधात् भवति सम्मोहः सम्मोहात् स्मृतिविभ्रमः स्मृतिर्भ्रंशात् बुद्धिनाशो बुद्धिनाशात् प्रणश्यते.
The man who is in search of a spiritual base for his life is forever faced with the problem of bridging the gulf between profession and practice. We say we know so much and yet are unable to translate what we know into action. Our behavior belies our belief. And yet the Gita says that he who regards knowledge and action as separate and different is an immature individual, devoid of true understanding. But most of us do regard knowledge and action as separate, with an unbridgeable gulf. As stated earlier, in Gita, Sankhya stands for knowledge and Yoga for action. But by and large, what we call knowledge is nothing but a set of beliefs. In other words, what we call knowledge is a mere accumulation of information. But the gulf between belief and behavior can never be bridged. Behavior is synonymous with life and therefore denotes a factor of dynamism, a factor of ceaseless movement. But belief is something static. It is fixed. How can a bridge ever be constructed between two points, one of which is static and the other tremendously dynamic? If such a bridge is constructed, it will collapse because of the ever-shifting point of behavior. But while the gulf between belief and behavior is unbridgeable, there exists no gulf between perception and practice. If perception is action, then a new dimension is introduced in the discussion of the subject, namely the philosophy of karma, which is one of the fundamental themes of the Bhagavad Gita. While discussing this important theme, the Gita speaks of action, reaction, and inaction. It is true that the Gita speaks of non-attachment in action, but this does not mean it speaks of non-action. Sri Krishna makes it quite clear to Arjuna that one does not come to non-attachment in action by refraining from activity. Non-attachment in action and involvement in activity are not contradictory. In fact, they must coexist. The Gita says that not even for one moment can man remain without performing action. In this connection, one must note that the approach of the Gita to the subject of karma or action is completely holistic, for it says that he who restrains organs of action but dwells in his thought on pleasures or pains of action is a dishonest man. The word used is mithyachar. The Gita makes a distinction between action, reaction, and inaction. Memory is the repository of likes and dislikes, of resistances and attachments. And so any action that emanates from the stimulation of memory is reaction or vikarma. Action never binds. It is reaction which is the cause of man's bondage. Reaction constitutes a chain, and so one who reacts strengthens that chain and is caught in it. The Gita says that he who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is a wise man. What does this mean? Action is a movement whether of the body or of consciousness. Every movement has a ground in which it moves. Usually the ground in which action moves is the ground of past memories, of likes and dislikes, of pain and pleasure. All our actions take place in the ground of memory. If they could take place in the ground of innocence, the ground free of the impressions of psychological memory, then is it the ground of inaction. Any action that takes place in this ground is free from all reactive tendencies. But inaction is not to be mistaken for non-action. In fact, non-action is a negative reaction. In the Gita, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that he cannot run away from the field of battle. But he also tells his disciple that he should fight not as others fight, but in a different manner. Arjuna asks that different way of fighting what it was. Sri Krishna replies by saying that Arjuna must fight without any excitement or without any stimulation. He must fight without causing any fever of the body or of the mind. This indeed is action, emerging from the ground of inaction. Sri Krishna tells his pupil that for this he will have to be steeped in yoga. The Bhagavad Gita is described as a book dealing with the science of yoga. But one may ask, what is the nature of this yoga, the yoga of the Bhagavad Gita?
Raga-dvesha-viyuktaistu Vishayanindriyaischaran Atma-vashyair-vidheyatma Prasadam-adigacchati Prasade-sarva-dukha Nasti buddhira yuktasya nacha yuktasya bhavana nacha bhavayata shantihi ashantasya kutasukham Indriyanam hicharatam yanmanonu vidhiyate tadasya harati तस्माद्यस्य महाबाहुः निगृहीतानि सर्वशः इन्द्रियाणीन्द्रियार्थेभ्यः तस्य प्रज्ञा प्रतिष्ठितम् यस्यां जाग्रति भूतानि सानिशा पश्यतो मुनेः आपूर्यमाणो अचल प्रतिष्ठम् आपूर्यमाणो अचल प्रतिष्ठम् समुद्रमाप प्रविशन्ति यद्वेत् तद्वेत् कामायं प्रविशन्ति सर्वे तद्वैत् कामायं प्रविशन्ति सर्वे स शान्तिमाप्नोति न कामकामी विहाय सर्वान् पुमाश्चरति निःस्पृहः निर्ममो निरहङ्कारः स शान्तिम् अधिगच्छति स शान्तिम् अधिगच्छति स शान्तिम् अधिगच्छति वैष्णवजनतो तेने
The yoga of the Bhagavad Gita is called the yoga of intelligence, not the yoga of intellect. The Gita says that intelligence is higher than the mind. The Gita calls it buddhi. It is only when there is the awakening of intelligence that the ground, free from all the conditioning factors of the mind, comes into existence. But then, what are the conditioning factors of the human mind? These are called gunas, or those attributes which are the functional base in the operational field of the mind. The attributes or gunas are threefold in nature. The Indian, more truly the Hindu psychology, is based on the functioning of these gunas. The entire manifestation rests on them. They exist in manifestation in certain proportions. Without them, no manifestation is possible. The gunas are stability or tamas, mobility or rajas, and harmony or sattva. The proportion in which these three exist in manifestation is not static but intensely dynamic and therefore ever moving. No manifestation is possible when all the three are in perfect balance. The three in varying proportion is the sign of manifestation. The Gita says that the gunas are the natural functionings of manifested life. When they are allowed to function naturally, then are harmony and health maintained. The mind of man must cooperate with nature and not try to overpower nature. We must be a collaborator with nature and not strive to become a master of nature. And so when the mind of man interferes with the natural functioning of gunas, that distortions arise. Life needs for its survival and expression stability, mobility and harmony. But when mind interferes with the functioning of the gunas, then stability degenerates into stagnation, mobility into restlessness, and harmony into self-righteousness. In order to become a collaborator with nature, man must rise above nature. Then will he be able to know the purpose of nature and work intelligently with her. This is what Sri Krishna tells Arjuna. He says that all knowledge is born of the gunas or the attributes. Knowledge is obviously of the mind. Sri Krishna wants Arjuna to rise above knowledge and attain to wisdom. Knowledge is of the mind. Wisdom transcends the limits of the mind. This knowledge of the mind is always relational. Mind knows a thing in relation to some other thing. Thus it is born of duality. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna to rise above the field of duality. According to the Gita, the non-dual is the seat of inaction. But one cannot always remain in the non-dual field. Life is a relationship in duality. Thus action is possible in the field of the dual. But this action becomes right when it emerges from the field of the non-dual.
No.
rajo raga atmakam vidhi trishna मध्ये तिष्ठन्ति राजसा जगन्यगुणवृत्तिस्थाः अधो गच्छन्ति तामसाः नान्यं गुणेभ्यकर्तारं यदा द्रष्टानुपश्यति गुणे मद्भावं सोधिगच्छति प्रकाशं च प्रवृत्तिं च प्रकाशं द्वेष्टि संप्रवृत्तानि न निवृत्तानि काङ्क्षति समं दुःख सुख स्वस्थः समालोष्टाश्म काञ्चनः तत्त्ववित्तु महाबाहो गुणकर्म विभागयोः गुणागुणेषु वर्तन्ते इति मत्वा न सज्जते त्रये गुण सत्त्वस्थो निर्योगक्षेम आत्मवान्
But then how can one rise to this level? If this alone is right action, then most people know not what action is. They are involved in reaction. Then is not the instruction of the Gita impractical, in as much as very few in humanity can follow it? Here the Gita utters a sublime truth for all social change. It says that whatever the spiritual man does is taken up as a hint by others, for he lays down a norm born out of his own experience, not a mere scriptural norm, and the norm born out of personal experience, is so powerful and effective that others willingly follow it. And this indeed is the basis of true social change. Such an individual can and does become a living center of true revolution. It is the spiritual man alone that acts. All else are in mere reaction. The Gita says that man's right is to act, but he can claim no right to its fruits. But will not such an action become utterly irresponsible? If one acts, but with no care for the fruits of action, then will he not act in such a manner and ride roughshod over the destinies of other people? The Gita seems to make a distinction between the results of action and the fruits of action. A spiritual man cannot be indifferent to the results of action, for the results affect other people, but the fruit is something which has a personal element in it. And so while fully careful as to the effects of action on other people, the spiritual man is unmindful of how it affects him personally. But when can one, while caring for the results of action, be utterly oblivious to the fruits that may accrue? The Gita here speaks in the language of a profound paradox, for it speaks of action without an actor. In fact, true action emerges only when there is no actor. The actor is the I. The Gita says that it is the man deluded by the sense of egoism, the sense of the I, who believes that it is he who has done this or that. He thinks that he is the actor and appropriates for himself all the credit for such action. It is the actor who constitutes the center from where reactions arise. It is when the center of I is dissolved that the field of inaction emerges. And from the field of inaction will arise true action. In the field of inaction, there is no duality of the actor and the thing acted upon, no duality of the observer and the observed, no duality of the perceiver and the perceived. It is indeed the point of right perception from where alone right action can emerge. But then, what is the nature of right perception?
Sarvaha Prakriti Jaya.
ते क्रियमाणानि गुणैः कर्माणि सर्वशः अहंकार विमूढात्मा कर्ताहम् इति मन्यते मयि सर्वाणि कर्माणि सन्न्यस्याद्यात्मचेतसा निराशैः निर्ममो भूत्वा युध्यस्व विगते ज्वरः श्रेयान् स्वधर्मो विगुणः परधर्मान् स्वनुष्ठितात् स्वधर्मे निदनं श्रेयः यद्यदाचरति श्रेष्ठः तत्तदेवेतरोज्जनः स यत्प्रमाणं कुरुते लोकः तदनुवर्तते लोकः तदनुवर्तते लोकः कवयोऽप्यत्र मोहिताः तत्ते कर्म प्रवक्ष्यामि यज्ञात्वा मोक्ष्यसे शुभात् कर्मणो ह्यपि बोद्धव्यं बोद्धव्यं च विकर्मणः अकर्मणश्च कर्मणो गते कर्मण्यकर्म यापश्येत् अकर्मणि च कर्म यः स बुद्धिमान् मनुष्येषु स युक्तः कृत्स्नकर्म कृत् कर्मण्येवाधिका श्रेयो हि ज्ञानमभ्यासात् ज्ञानात् ध्यानं विशिष्यते ध्यानात् कर्मफलत्यागः त्यागात् शान्तिः अनन्तरं त्यागात् शान्तिः